Welcome to the 18th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a new podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. On October 18th, we travel to Clayton, Missouri for a State of the Science Summit on the treatment of hematologic malignancies. The meeting covered novel agents and combinations in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, advances in acute myeloid leukemia, management of newly diagnosed and relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, progress in myeloproliferative neoplasms, patient selection for Hodgkin lymphoma therapy, and current data with chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy. The field of hematologic oncology is rapidly progressing with novel agents. In addition to several recent FDA approvals throughout 2018, dosing and schedule modifications, rationale for treatment discontinuation, and encouraging activity with CAR T-cells continue to define the field. The multiple myeloma armamentarium recently gained another triplet regimen, following the FDA approval of elotuzumab in combination with pomalidomide and dexamethasone. This was approved for the treatment of patients with relapsed refractory multiple myeloma following two or more prior therapies, including lenalidomide and a proteasome inhibitor. In CML, the 144-week results from the ENASTOP trial of long-term treatment-free remissions in patients with chronic phase CML stopping second-line nilotinib were presented at the 2018 ASCO annual meeting. Though the approach is not suitable for every patient who receives nilotinib, results showed that 48.4% of patients were able to sustain their remission. Treating physicians can consult the current NCCN guidelines that outline the criteria that qualify patients for treatment discontinuation. In August 2018, the FDA granted a breakthrough therapy designation to quizartinib for the treatment of adult patients with relapse refractory FLT3-ITT-positive AML, based on findings from the Phase 3 QuANTUM-R study. In the trial, the FLT3 inhibitor reduced the risk of death by 24% versus salvage chemotherapy following frontline treatment with or without hematopoietic stem cell transplant. This is the first FLT3 inhibitor to demonstrate a substantial improvement in overall survival compared with chemotherapy in relapse refractory patients. In the world of Hodgkin lymphoma, following the release of the Phase 3 Echelon 1 trial, the FDA approved brentuximab vedotin in combination with chemotherapy as frontline therapy for adult patients with stage 3 or 4 classical Hodgkin lymphoma. The addition of brentuximab vedotin to adriamycin, vinblastine, and dacarbazine, known as AVD, reduced the risk of progression, death, or initiation of new therapy by 23% compared with the chemotherapy regimen plus bleomycin. Moreover, the FDA granted a priority designation to a supplemental new drug application for ibrutinib in combination with obinutuzumab as first-line therapy for adult patients with CLL. The announcement was made on October 17th, following the release of results from the Phase 3 ILLUMINATE trial, which demonstrated a significant gain in progression-free survival over chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab. As the treatment armamentarium continues to grow, it becomes increasingly important to consider the potential drawbacks of therapy and treatment selection. At the meeting, we asked each faculty member to provide a word of caution for physicians to be mindful of when treating patients. First, we spoke with one of the co-chairs of the meeting, Brad S. Call, MD, who is a professor in the Department of Medicine at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis and a member of the Siteman Cancer Center. Call addressed the toxicities of these targeted agents.
Well, the first big decision that clinicians will be faced with when they're starting a patient on frontline treatment with CLL is whether to give them traditional immunochemotherapy for younger patients that typically was the FCR regimen. For patients I'll call older, bendamustine rituximab is typically a very good choice and commonly used. And for much older patients, then regimens like chlorambucil obinutuzumab is a very reasonable choice. But a couple of years ago, the BTK inhibitor ibrutinib was approved for frontline use. And so now any patient could be offered that option, and it creates some interesting choices for the clinician and for the patient. Ibrutinib is incredibly active in CLL, high response rates, and very durable, high-quality remissions. On the other hand, ibrutinib is meant to be administered as chronic daily therapy, whereas these other choices I mentioned earlier are all finite durations of therapy. And so patients can look forward to being done with their treatment in about 6 months' time and then being completely free of treatment, which isn't true with ibrutinib. And so there's really the trade-off. More toxicity in the short run, but then a treatment-free interval or chronic daily therapy with ibrutinib. And we really lack the comparative data right now to tell you you should choose one over the other. And so we're operating in a world where we are just making educated guesses on behalf of our patients and then really having this discussion with our patients and going through the trade-offs, the pros and the cons of the two different treatment strategies, and then you try to make a decision jointly about what will be your choice for frontline treatment.
Following Dr. Call, we spoke with Jeffrey Wee, MD, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Oncology, Section of Bone Marrow Transplantation at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and a member of Siteman Cancer Center. AML had a progressive year in terms of therapeutic development. Over the past 1.5 years, the field has gained 5 FDA approvals: mitostarin, enasidenib, CPX351, gemtuzumab ozogamicin, and ivosidenib. In our interview, we spoke to the heterogeneity of the disease and detailed the optimal application of these therapies.
I think it's becoming much more complicated to select appropriate therapy for your newly diagnosed patients. I think it's really important to risk stratify these patients upfront, including cytogenetics and molecular data to determine what appropriate induction therapy is. And I think that for the relapse refractory patients and older patients who may be unfit for intensive chemotherapy, we have additional drugs that can potentially target specific mutations within their leukemia that can be tolerated by these patients. I think really we're looking at AML as a collection of diseases, and each of these agents has a specific role. For example, mitostarin is approved for the FLT3 mutated patients. Vyxeos was primarily tested in older secondary AML patients, and we are using Mylotarg with increasing frequency for patients with good risk AML. Again, we are seeing several new agents that are targeting specific recurrent mutations in AML be tested in clinical trials. We should see the results of these studies in the next few years, and hopefully that will lead to more drug approvals. And as we get further and further into these studies, again, it'll be very important to understand the genetics of AML, the particular mutations that these patients may harbor, to best select their potentially a targeted therapy for their disease.
Ravi Vij, MD, MBA, co-chair of the meeting, detailed the treatment regimens that require careful monitoring in transplant-eligible and ineligible patients, specifically those that include a proteasome inhibitor such as carfilzomib or a chemotherapy such as melphalan. Vij is a professor of medicine within the Division of Oncology, Section of Bone Marrow Transplant at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and a member of Siteman Cancer Center.
As far as multiple myeloma goes, we made tremendous strides in the treatment of multiple myeloma. The paradigm that has evolved for multiple myeloma is one of continuous therapy. The algorithm at the beginning initiates at the point of determination of whether a patient is transplant eligible or not. If a patient is stem cell transplant eligible, that remains the standard of care. For most patients who undergo a stem cell transplant, most institutions would deem that to be part of their initial therapy, given the superior progression-free survival that continues to be demonstrated in even recent studies. So the paradigm there is to give an induction period of treatment. The optimal induction regimen is clearly not known. I think the most popular one is the 3-drug regimen of bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. The regimen was shown to be superior to lenalidomide and dexamethasone in a SWOG study. Though that study was not meant for patients who were proceeding to transplant, I think that did inform the decision that three drugs are better than two. The use of our novel agents in frontline is what continues to be explored. The substitution of bortezomib with carfilzomib is one thing that I think a lot of investigators are pursuing, and even off-study has started becoming a regimen that some institutions have adopted. The use of carfilzomib is primarily driven by studies that have shown that when given either with or without a transplant, the depth of response that is achieved appears to be better than what we have achieved historically with other regimens. Certainly, frontline KRD is being compared to bortezomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in a randomized study, which is completed accrual and hopefully will then better inform our decision on which of the three-drug regimens is optimal. However, I think that very soon we probably will move into the era of four-drug treatment, and therein I think the use of monoclonal antibodies with our three-drug backbone is where the field is going to move. Daratumumab and elotuzumab both are being explored in frontline trials. The trial data at this time is fairly preliminary, and I think that it is, however, a matter of time before four-drug regimens best three-drug regimens in comparative studies. Certainly, this will add to the cost of the regimen. Some feel that the cost may be justifiable if one can perhaps give a finite period of therapy and thereby avoid the costs associated with more extended therapy that we give today. So I think that for patients who are transplant eligible, once they've had their transplant, maintenance therapy is the standard. Most patients get lenalidomide as maintenance therapy. I also feel that it is probably not enough to do lenalidomide alone for high-risk patients. So patients who have deletion of 17p have other chromosomal abnormalities like 414, 1420, 1416, I think could benefit by the addition of a proteasome inhibitor to the mix. So therein, we are using Velcade twice monthly with lenalidomide as maintenance therapy, though there is no randomized data to suggest that dual maintenance is better. There was a trial done by the group at Emory looking at extended period of VRD post-transplant that showed that there were fairly impressive rates of PFS. In the post-transplant setting, another thing that has been explored is the use of consolidation. The use of consolidation remains experimental. In a large U.S. study, the STAMINA study, it did not seem to add to the PFS, nor did the use of tandem transplantation. However, another study done in Europe by the EMN group did show an improvement in PFS, both by the addition of a second transplant and by the use of consolidation therapy. The contradictory results of these two studies may be predicated on the kind of regimens that were used pre-transplant, so I think that it remains a matter of conjecture as to why these divergent results were produced. So I think that at least in most institutions, consolidation is not a routine part of management. However, if patients don't achieve a very good partial response, a lot of investigators and treating physicians do consider on a case-by-case basis the use of consolidation to deepen the response post-transplant.
Transitioning to relapse refractory disease was Mark Schroeder, MD, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Section of Bone Marrow Transplantation and Leukemia at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and a member of Siteman Cancer Center. As there are several treatment regimens for patients with relapsed refractory myeloma, Schroeder counseled physicians on the available regimens, reminding them to use an individualized treatment approach.
Well, it leaves potentially three options for physicians that have a patient that has seen lenalidomide or is refractory to lenalidomide. They all seem to be active in that patient population. The most active in terms of depth of the response seems to be the combination of daratumumab, carfilzomib, dexamethasone, with a very good partial response rate of over 70%. The second most active was the study of pomalidomide, Velcade, dexamethasone, with a very good partial response rate of around 50%. And the, in terms of activity, depth of response, ELO, POM, DEX had the least effective depth of response. However, progression-free survival in these two large randomized studies, either the elotuzumab Eloquent 3 study, the Optimism study, showed that the intervention arm was improved progression-free survival. So there's, I think, really three choices, at least based on those studies, more than that realistically in terms of treating relapsed refractory multiple myeloma patients. Typically, in regimens that contain pomalidomide, my own experience is that patients do develop neutropenia, and there are dose reductions that occur when combining pomalidomide, whether it's with Velcade dexamethasone or combining pomalidomide with daratumumab. In general, though, these toxicities are manageable, and patients can get through the therapy without major issues. Infusion reactions to daratumumab-based regimens are possible, but certainly with the split dosing regimen, infusion reactions are decreased and the infusion time is less in that setting. And with good pre-dosing, infusion-related reactions are certainly less common now. And in terms of elotuzumab experience, in general, because of the lack of single-agent activity and these current studies now testing the use of elotuzumab in relapsed refractory myeloma, that has not been a common agent of use outside of a clinical study in my practice.
Putting some perspective on the landscape of myelofibrosis and polycythemia vera was Stephen O., MD, PhD, and Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Hematology at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and a member of Siteman Cancer Center.
So in the case of myelofibrosis, historically we've used, or most of us have used, the IPSS or DIPSS or DIPS plus for risk stratification. And that does not take into account any of the particular molecular markers in this disease. More recently, not only have we learned about the specific driver mutations such as JAK2, CALR, and MPL, but also that many patients harbor concomitant mutations and other driver mutations such as ASXL1, in some cases IDH1 or 2, et cetera. And so some of the more recently published prognostic scoring systems are taking these into account. One of which, for example, which I will discuss, is the MIPS-70, which the M stands for molecular, so this incorporates some of these high-risk mutations such as ASXL1, so that we can better understand the impact of these types of mutations on the long-term prognosis for patients with myelofibrosis. And this is becoming particularly more relevant as many practitioners are beginning to test for these types of mutations in routine clinical practice. Each of the other JAK inhibitors besides ruxolitinib has had various issues with safety concerns and FDA holds in some cases. So where we stand with these compounds, so for instance, momelotinib, the unique aspect of that drug is that it seems to improve anemia in a subset of patients. Now, that drug was being developed by Gilead, and the development of that drug was discontinued by Gilead. However, very recently, the rights to the drug were acquired by Sierra Oncology. So at this point, it sounds like there are plans for further development of the drugs, but we'll have to see. In the case of pacritinib, the unique aspect of that drug, at least in part, is that it seems to be safe for those patients even with very low platelet count. There was an FDA hold for that drug due to safety concerns. That hold was lifted, and a new study, which is ongoing, is being conducted to address those safety concerns, essentially to determine if there is what is essentially the lowest dose that can be safely and effectively administered in patients with myelofibrosis. So it'll still be some time before that drug would potentially be approved, but it's at this point is still a viable candidate. And the last one, fedratinib, had been put on FDA hold due to concerns over Wernicke's-like encephalopathy syndrome that had been reported in several patients treated with the drug. That FDA hold has been lifted, and that drug now is being redeveloped by Celgene. So we'll see with a new study going forward if that pans out.
Next, we spoke with Nancy Bartlett, MD, who was the Komen Chair in Medical Oncology at the Washington University School of Medicine and a member of Siteman Cancer Center. Though brentuximab and AVD were FDA approved in March 2018, Bartlett explained that the regimen is not suitable for every patient with classical Hodgkin lymphoma with advanced disease. Hear her take on available regimens and which she advises physicians on the toxicities to be aware of.
So I'm really only using it in the very highest risk patients, so patients who have an IPS of 4 to 7, patients who have stage 4 disease, because that's where the highest benefit was seen. So I really haven't incorporated it for some of the reasons that have been mentioned, which are the financial toxicity, the neurotoxicity, the myelosuppression, with really a sort of a modest improvement in the PFS. So for the low or intermediate risk patients, I continue just to use ABVD and then eliminate the bleomycin after 2 cycles. So the next trial for these advanced stage patients, which is being developed by the cooperative groups and hopefully should open the first quarter, maybe late first quarter of 2019, is actually a randomized trial comparing AVD plus brentuximab, so the AAVD regimen, to AVD plus nivolumab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor, which has been very active in refractory patients. And so I think that's one option. At some point, we may get to using AVD plus brentuximab plus nivolumab. That will be financial toxicity as well.
Finally, Armin Gobadi, MD, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Medical Oncology at Washington University School of Medicine and a member of Siteman Cancer Center, gave a thorough overview of the clinical utility of CAR T-cell therapy. Gobadi spoke to how researchers are working to maximize the therapy's benefit across both solid tumor and blood oncology.
This is a new, basically, treatment or a platform of treatment that is really is going to revolutionize the way that we treat cancer in general. And already has changed the way that we treat hematologic malignancies, but cancers in general too. And as we know, has been approved for a high-grade B-cell lymphoma. There are 2 products that are approved for the high-grade B-cell lymphoma. They've been relapsed refractory and young adult and pediatric up to age 25, and young adult up to age 25, that they can get this get CAR T-cell for relapsed refractory ALL. So that's the first thing of it that we're going to talk. And the second thing is going to be, obviously, there are side effects here, and those are the main side effects are CRS and neurotoxicity. Those side effects, the reason that those treatments are given in a specific center is because you need to have experience with managing those side effects, but almost always are reversible. You can treat them with the current management that we have, and usually that's a steroid or using IL-6 receptor blocking agent like tocilizumab. With the combination of those, you can manage almost all of them. And so the caveat there is, you know, CAR T-cell is a really effective treatment. It's going to change the way that we treat cancer in general, but still we need to make it better. One is in terms of efficacy, how we can make it better. 2, in terms of side effects, how we can make it safer. And 3 is we know that it's really effective for heme malignancies. We need to broaden basically a spectrum of disease that we go after, not just blood cancer, but also in solid tumors. That's the more difficult things to tackle. And actually, we have a clinical trial right now. We have a CAR T-cell for ovarian cancer that we give it to a patient with ovarian cancer. But that's going to change. The science of it is evolving. That's going to change in the next few years, 5 to 10 years. We're going to have new in terms of preclinical data, and also hopefully in the early phase clinical trial, we're going to have effective CAR T-cell therapy for other cancer like solid tumors even.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 18th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have 2 upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you want to hear more on the therapeutic advances in immunotherapy, precision medicine, and neuroscience, consider registering for the State of the Science Summit on Breast Cancer on December 13th in New York City. For those of you on the West Coast, we'll also be in Seattle, Washington on December 13th for a State of the Science Summit on genitourinary cancers. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.